Hello, I'm Janet Silver from Syntax Strategic.
And I'm Cameron Groom from Microbix Biosystems. Thank you for joining us for Diagnostics Beyond the Lab. On this podcast series, we talk to industry leaders in the scientific and health community about discoveries, challenges, and what they see as the way forward in their fields.
Cameron, I'm really excited about today because we're going to talk about the human papillomavirus, or HPV, vaccines, testing, and cervical cancer. And on the latter, according to the Canadian Cancer Society, over 1,400 women across the country will be diagnosed with this kind of cancer this year alone.
Quite right, Janet. And well, the HPV vaccines target HPV types that most commonly cause cervical cancer. They're certainly not mandatory, and they don't protect against disease from all possible oncogenic or cancer-causing HPV types. So we always have to ask ourselves, you know, what does this mean and where do we go from here? And joining us now to break all this down is Dr. Larry Vaughn, Director of R&D Scientific Affairs Integrated Diagnostic Solutions at Becton Dickinson, which is, of course, one of the largest global medical technologies firms in the world. And also, we're very pleased to have Dr. Kathy Popadyuk, an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology from Memorial University in Newfoundland and a member of numerous leadership committees at CPAC and other important cervical cancer screening initiatives. So we thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and hello.
Good. Well, why don't we start with talking a little bit about what HPV is, the human papillomavirus, and talking about a bit of its health consequences.
Thank you. Why don't I start then? The human papillomavirus has actually been around for millennia, forever, well before us. And there are low-risk types and high-risk types. And the low-risk types we're very familiar with. They cause warts. The regular warts, and for the purpose of our discussion today, we're interested in genital warts. The high-risk types also can cause trouble. They can get into cells, get into the DNA, embed in there, and over years go on to develop precancer and cancer in some people. And that's what we're interested in today, preventing those high-risk HPV types from causing problematic precancer and cancer.
Kathy, you talked about prevention. Sorry, Cameron. I just want to jump in, if I may, because both of my children have been vaccinated with the HPV vaccine. So when you're talking about prevention, what does that vaccine mean, and does it really protect them?
Well, we're very fortunate because many years ago, about 1996, seven, it's been that many years, or 2006, seven, we had the development of HPV vaccines, a number of them, and they include HPV 16 and 18 types, which are considered high-risk HPVs that can go on to cause precancer and cancer, and some of them also cover HPV 6 and 11, which cover the lower-risk types that can cause genital warts. More recent vaccines, the nonavalent, the 9-valent, also cover 5 more high-risk HPV types. The high-risk HPV 16 and 18 cause 70% of cervical cancer and many of the precancers. The newer vaccines that cover up to 7 high-risk types of HPV can prevent 90% of cervical cancers. And very importantly, I don't know if your children are boys or girls, but boys can be affected by HPV precancers and cancers. Everyone can be affected by the precancer and cancer in the anal skin, the head and neck. HPV 16 can cause cancer and precancer there. For women, we can have problems in the vagina and outside on the vulvar skin. And men can be affected by penile precancer and cancer. So these vaccines have the opportunity to prevent the development of infection, precancer, and cancer of these conditions. So they are very, very efficacious. And those who've been vaccinated before being exposed to these HPV types, which often means before sexual debut in adolescents and teens.
But these are great points, Kathy, and you touch on the diversity of types of the HPV virus. And maybe I can ask Larry to supplement on that. You know, based on how many types there are, we've got these progressing vaccines that cover more types, but is screening and testing still necessary, Larry, in light of these vaccines?
Yes, it is. And despite the fact that these vaccines are highly efficacious, there are a couple of factors that mean we're really going to have to keep screening for decades to come. The first is, even in a highly vaccinated country, and we're not one of the most in North America here, but certainly in Australia or United Kingdom, 80% or so is the highest you'll get. We're in the 50s to 60% pre-COVID down here in the U.S., so we have a gap there. Secondly, there's a time lag when most, as Kathy was pointing out, most vaccines are delivered to young kids around 11 or so of age, and it takes another 10 to 15 years for them to get into the screening age-appropriate screening pool. So you have that gap to cover. So we're now seeing the benefits of the 2006 vaccine that Kathy mentioned in the clinic today. We will need to wait till about 2030 for the 9-valent vaccines to have an impact in the clinic. So we've got that gap. And finally, even with the 9-valent, it's 90%. So there's still a 10% cancer attribution out there that we need to cover. So we definitely don't want to take our foot off the gas on screening. And I would add, and I'm sure Kathy would agree, since COVID, that's even more, there's more urgency around that on both the vaccination side and also on the screening side, because we've had a serious dip in both of those areas.
I just want to back up for a second. We're talking about screening. Kathy, as a woman, I've had a number of pap smears. How is that different than an HPV test?
Well, as we've heard, a number of countries in the world are arguably ahead of Canada in our vaccination rates. There's a difference across the country. I'm presently in Newfoundland, and we're very proud of our vaccination rates. They're about 94% for our school-based programs. I also didn't comment that there's efficacy from these vaccines, even in older people who've been exposed. There still is benefit, but not as good. For women, pap smears are done, you know, every 3 years. And you know, you go and have a speculum exam and you have the test done. And then the cells are looked at under the microscope. And the technician or the pathologist looks at the cells, and by then there are changes already there that could be precancer or cancer. And that's done every 3 years. An HPV test is looking for the virus. The virus, whether it's present, has it been there for a while to get in the cells? And by being positive for the virus, it picks up more opportunities for cancer and precancer. So it picks up things earlier, before they are in the cells. It identifies more women. And the test, if you have a negative test, the durability, the confidence you have that there isn't a problem and there won't be a problem, is 5 years. And that's more confidence for women than having a pap test every 3 years, because we know that the durability, the confidence that you won't develop a problem with a cytology pap test is only 3 years. But the woman receiving the test will feel exactly the same thing. You're just taking a sample during a speculum exam from the cervix.
Well, I think, you know, that covers a bit of the interval issue that we should touch on, and the migration of moving from looking for cells that have been transformed by the virus to looking upstream for the presence of the virus should be intuitive of everyone, for everyone. But maybe I can ask Larry a little bit. If you're doing an HPV test that screens for the different types of HPV, we mentioned some of the virus types that are covered by the vaccine, but how many types of virus are there? Maybe you can speak to that, and and about the different sites in the body that can affect as well.
Sure. Well, generally speaking, most people say there are 14 high-risk types. I mean, there's been some fine-tuning over the last 2 years where type 66 is kind of being downgraded. But generally speaking, all the assays have 14 high-risk types in them. So those are the ones that can persist and cause invasive cancer over time. In terms of other sites, I mean, as Kathy mentioned in the introduction, we have, you know, penile, anal cancers, and I think, and head and neck cancers. I think the two most active areas of research are moving to guidance now are for the head and neck space and for the anal cancer area. For head and neck, I mean, really there's an epidemic now of head and neck cancer, particularly in white males, where we've seen a huge uptick in the number of HPV-related cancers in recent years. And it's now surpassed several years ago the incidence of cervical cancer. So actually, I saw some numbers where, you know, there are more, there are about the same number of people dying of head and neck cancers now as there is of entire diagnoses of cervical. So it's about threefold more. So we have a serious issue there. And I think we're starting to see some not quite guidance in the sense of as we have for cervical, but there's certainly a lot more research and there's testing going on. As Kathy will tell you, it's actually ironically better to have an HPV-related head and neck cancer. The prognosis is better and there's testing going on now. They want to identify if it's alcohol or tobacco or HPV, and there are different, there's de-escalation of therapies if it's HPV-related. But it's still a very serious cancer and has a high mortality rate.
And testing, the need to test certainly isn't going away for cervical or head and neck.
Right. And for just to finish up on the head and neck, it's, a lot of it's tissue testing. There's a little sample type difference there. And there was a big study in the U.S. Just published in June called the ANCHOR study, which really showed that for an anal cancer has kind of very similar pathophysiology to cervical cancer. There's an anal pap, which and degrees of progression like you have for cervical. So there's a pathway there to both diagnosing from an anal pap side and also from HPV test side. So we expect to see guidance in the U.S. very shortly now that they've shown that you can actually drive down the anal cancer rate by treating high-grade disease, pre-cancer. So that's very encouraging.
And what about access to care and access to family doctors, OBGYNs by community? Certainly we see in Canada, for example, a lot of patients have difficulty finding a family doctor. Is this an issue in this area, Larry? And by extension, Kathy?
Sure. I mean, even pre-COVID, about 1 in 5 U.S. women never got screened or were not screened on time. So that's a serious problem. And actually, the numbers reflect that over 50% of all diagnosed cancers are in that 20% of women who don't show up for screening. So that is the problem statement right there. And that's, as I said, gotten worse with COVID. We have a huge reduction in the number of screened women and a backlog now that we will not be able to catch up, quite honestly, unless we do something differently. So there is a real concern there. Kathy, did you want?
No, I totally agree that the biggest issue is not necessarily the screening test, but being to be able to avail of being screened by someone. And access to care providers right now is a huge challenge. In my province, across the country, people can't access a primary care provider right now. And this is not something at this time that we can do over a telephone or a virtual visit. Pap smears, testing for cervical issues has to be done in person, and it takes time and human resources. And this is a huge challenge everywhere right now for us in Canada.
This brings up, Kathy, your the whole idea of self-collection. How important would self-collection be for women, and how would it change, if you will, or shift what we're seeing now?
And even what do we mean by the term would be important to explain.
Right. Very true, because a lot of people don't understand what self-collection is. They might think that one can get a blood test or do a swab of the throat looking for HPV for the cervix, but nope. Still need to take a sample to self-collect from the cervix inside the vagina. So it means using a tool. So some women are more facile with tampons, their own, you know, personally understanding their lower genital tract. Other women might find it taboo to explore down there. So it's definitely demographics of women who would be able to avail of a test where they could use a tool, be it like a little Q-tip. There are like flock swabs and tools created to be able to get close to the cervix personally, to take a sample and then to put it in appropriate packaging and send that off for an HPV test. It cannot be a cytology cell path test where someone is going to look at it under the microscope. There is no self-testing of cytology tests. That would be for a molecular, like an HPV test. So there are opportunities to use this type of technology where we haven't been able to allow women to self-sample. Right now in Canada, there is no actual self-sampling program or testing. There are a number of pilots that have been done across the country showing that women, a proportion of women would want this, they're comfortable with this, and then they can follow up for an examination for someone to see their cervix as needed, if needed, depending on the result. So this is work in progress. It's really exciting. We believe it will be very helpful for women who are unable to avail of a care provider or just are in circumstances that they're too busy and their time commitments, they can't go out to a clinic, there isn't a clinic, and that they can have a test done to look for potentially, you know, HPV that can cause precancer and cancer.
That's a great explanation, Kathy. I know, you know, Canada, we're just starting, the first provinces are just starting to get ready to provide molecular HPV screening programs, and, you know, self-collection is some way away. But some other areas of the world are more advanced on that. And maybe I could ask Larry to comment about what BD is thinking and doing in this respect.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's absolutely right to say that we're a little behind, I think, in North America, but I think we have a plan to catch up. But right now, the self-collected devices are CE marked. There are several available in Europe. So we have a number of choices of devices. They are now being implemented into national screening programs such as Denmark and Sweden and others. So they've started, Australia's all added that. Initially, it'll be added at the clinic, but just to explain, that's even by itself, that's a huge add-on because, you know, as Kathy mentioned, a lot of people have difficulty getting to a GP or even an OBGYN who does a pelvic exam. This does not require a pelvic exam. Could be done in the bathroom of any clinic, you know, a local provider. So I see that just expands the umbrella of coverage immediately by allowing that approval. The other thing, of course, the end game with self-collection is to be able to ship the kit to the home. And we now have good data on, and we do, this is what we call dry collection, so there's no liquid sent to the home. The simple brush device or swab, as Kathy mentioned, can be used. And the woman just simply self-collects, puts that in a container, puts it in the mail, and the lab then takes it from there and processes the sample. And a lot of data now, meta-analysis and randomized controlled trials show that if done properly with an approved test, it's just as effective. It's what we call non-inferior to the physician sample in terms of sensitivity. So I think we're already seeing that in places like Denmark, we're ahead. They initially offered it to underserved women who were not showing up for screening. They obviously picked up more cases there, and then they extended it to as an alternative to women who are in the regular screen program. And not surprisingly, ladies, you would agree that it's a nice option. So they like to take that option. And what they find is that they not only they do it, but they request it the next time. So it will expand coverage. And I think in 5 to 10 years, once it's adopted, it'll become like a pregnancy test. It'll be freely available. It'll be the first line test, and then the woman would come into the clinic or to our OBGYN or our physician for a follow-up on a positive test. So I think that's the future. And it's going to come quickly, too. And we can talk about the U.S. in a bit in a minute.
Can I just interject for a second? Because you're talking about self-collection and a woman being able to do that from her home. But Cameron, I know that Microbix has a lot of experience in this area in terms of accuracy. And from a layman's point of view, how do you ensure that whatever you're collecting, that the test is accurate, that the controls are there, that you're not going to find yourself getting a false report, if you will.
Well, you're raising a great point, Janet, and there are internal controls that are built in within tests, like those by Beck and Dickinson, that ensure that the instrument is functioning properly. Where we really step in and take a role is in the whole process, what are called external controls. So you need to make certain that the whole process of, you know, will the sample survive the mail and the heat? Will the technician be doing the steps in the right order? Will the reagents not be spoiled? Will the instrument not drift out of calibration? So there's a regular process of challenging with a representative mimic of a patient sample to ensure the validity of that whole process. And that's where microbics plays a role in all this, in period regularly challenging the whole test process to make sure there isn't any breakdown in the integrity of the process. And it's you can't overstate what an advancement this is to move from detecting cells that are already transforming or been transformed into cancer versus looking 5 or more years upstream to those at risk. But it has to be done properly and be regularly revalidated.
I know we only have a couple of minutes left, and we've probably got something that we would like to ask each one of you, but Kathy, I'll throw it to you first. We're talking about self-collection. How, if we're able to get down to this road shortly in Canada, how would that impact testing in Canada?
Well, as we heard, it probably would be able to be offered to women who can't access a healthcare area, a clinic. And it can be mailed. And certainly in Newfoundland, we've done studies on that. Northern Ontario, BC is leading the country in studies of mailing back your sample. For FIT testing, for colorectal screening, we've heard about that. The public is used to that. And that will potentially fill a void of people, of women who can't access to do a test and want to. So that is very, very helpful. And we also heard some women they might need some guidance, and you could also do it in clinic. And that would also potentially increase the number of people who could be tested in clinic environments, where some could be going through a speculum, the formal procedure with a healthcare provider, and someone could bring their self-collection kit if they needed some extra guidance also there. There's a vast array of opportunities where it could be integrated into what's already happening to increase the number of women who can be able to be screened. That's the most important thing.
Fabulous. And Larry, what points would you want to touch upon with regards to the work that you're doing and making sure we're covering the appropriate number of HPV types, helping ensure that those tests are optimally accurate as well?
Yeah, well, I think we know what the types are to cause cancers. We know one of the great things about cervical cancer is we know exactly what to do, but the question is implementation, right? So I think self-collection will be a huge add-on to a robust kind of vaccination program. And I can see it being used, you know, persistence is the main cause of disease. So a persistent infection of the same type is really what gets women in trouble if their immune system doesn't clear it. So having the ability to add the self-collection to a regularly screened woman, she's coming, come back and say, I'll send you a kit in 6 months. It really provides more information without having her to bring her back in. So I think that's important. But coming back to your direct question, having that internal control and knowing that the woman collected it correctly, and having a qualified assay is going to be key. And again, we've already demonstrated this in other national programs, so we do know what to do. I think there just has to be a will to get it done and to expand testing. And again, to come back to COVID, I am concerned that we will see an uptick. We're already seeing an uptick in disease in the clinic. I talked to a clinician the other day. He said, I'm doing more colposcopies. I'm seeing high-grade disease. This wave's already here, and we also have the add-on of those kids who didn't get vaccinated, who are going to be, you know, further down the line, they'll be showing up in the clinic as well without the adequate coverage. So we do need to act now, I think, and get self-collection rolled out to these people.
Missed medical appointments, missed vaccines, and the hangover of that from COVID.
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, certainly, you know, we're also looking at providing services to assist different provinces and different jurisdictions in their implementation of HPV molecular testing and having the not just the products but also the services to help support these great initiatives.
Following up on what Larry said, people have been sitting at home, not being able to avail of any health care. And these tests that we're talking about are not a substitute, be it if you can access self-collection or so on. If a woman has symptoms, pain, bleeding, discharge, other problems, that's not a screening test. She has to be seen by a care provider. So I don't want the audience to think that these tests are a replacement when Correct. Someone actually has symptoms. This is for the well population. Yeah. You know, Correct. It's exciting, but we have a lot of work ahead with COVID.
No substitute for primary care.
Right.
Correct.
Great point.
Thank you.
Thank
Kathy.
You. Larry Vaughn with Becton Dickinson, based in Maryland, and Dr. Kathy Papaduke from Memorial University in St. John's. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you again, Kathy, Larry, and Janet. That's all the time we have for today, and look forward to the next webinar in our series. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.